Her chest went tight. It never is. I want you to remember the ways we've discussed coping during times like these. Insulate yourself as much as possible from the news. Find distractions. Focus on your future plans, and above all, reach out if it becomes too much. She had to look away from the intensity in his gaze. There's no shame in any of that, Janie. You've come so far. The last thing we want at this point is for you to have... I'm not going to have a setback. God, she hated that word. And the memories that accompanied it.
I wasn't going to say that.
But she knew that he'd been thinking it.
Something so similar happening nearby is bound to summon memories of the most painful time in your life. There are healthy and unhealthy ways to deal with that. Use the healthy tools we've worked on over the years.
There was little she wouldn't do to avoid that topic. Searching for a change of subject, she asked, "Can I get your advice on something?" Looking pleased, the doctor nodded. Before she could change her mind, she ran a carefully edited version of the pictures and the website by him. "Have you seen sites like that? Can the owner be traced, like if the police knew about it?"
"I'm familiar with sites like you describe. Some are actually fronts for some pretty dark stuff. Child prostitution, sex trafficking, you name it. Or the person behind the site might be gathering these images through illegal means like hacking. There may be a chance some of these girls were coerced."
She thought about the pictures of Kelsey. There had been at least half a dozen photos in the envelope she'd found 7 years ago. After one shocked glance through them, she'd focused on the money. I wonder if they're getting paid to do it. Dr. Drake looked skeptical.
"It's possible, of course. But sites like these are usually exploitive in nature. They exist for the gratification of others. It's doubtful they'd be paid at all, or at least no more than a pittance."
$1,000 wasn't a pittance. A greasy tangle of nerves knotted in her belly, not unlike the feeling she'd gotten when she'd found that envelope under the mattress in her bedroom. She'd known immediately that Kelsey had hidden it there. It hadn't been the first time her sister had stashed something in Janie's room. It had been a joke between them. The way Kelsey kept her bedroom was a guarantee there would always be someone poking around in it, cleaning or just checking on the condition of the space before nagging Kelsey to pick it up. Janie's room was pristine by comparison.
"You seem really bothered by this."
She refocused on the therapist.
"The police should be alerted. With the girls you've already identified, they'd have a place to start by talking to the known victims and their families to see if they can get a lead on how the pictures ended up online. And, more important, if any of the girls pictured were victimized in any way."
Her pulse went to ice, and abruptly the mental scenarios she'd been working through for the last couple of days clarified. If her mother had been telling the truth about turning that envelope over to the state agents 7 years ago, none of this would be new information. It would have all been part of the investigation. But in the last few years, Janie had become an expert on Claire Willard's moods. And she knew when her mother was lying.
Claire Willard, November 9th, 4:40 p.m. "Honestly," Barbara said with a sigh, "I think the citywide rummage sale is such a great fundraiser. But is it my imagination, or does the organization and pricing get more complicated every year?"
"It's not your imagination at all." Claire smiled at Barbara. "I struggled with how to even group some of the donations. I mean, a cardboard animal head?" Barbara chuckled as she turned onto the private drive leading to Claire's neighborhood. "It's an eye-opener to realize what some will spend their money on."
"It'll probably be more so when we see how quickly those items go at the sale." The two laughed as Claire's house came into sight. She was feeling more than a bit pleased with herself. For the entire weekend, she'd been unable to shake the thoughts of the Claire who had existed prior to marriage. Everyone changed over the years, so it should be equally possible for her to shift back to that independent woman she'd once been.
the one who had deftly juggled so many balls with little help from her overworked mother. This morning, Claire had taken a baby step toward that end when readying for the day. Just one yellow pill, and the busyness of the subsequent hours had kept her engaged and focused. As successes went, it was minuscule, but it represented an accomplishment for her, like developing long unused muscles. Rebuilding her inner resolve would take time. The road to change would be paved with tiny steps, just like these. The fact that she was even considering the need to make adjustments was a monumental leap forward. "I'm thinking of getting a job." The barely formulated thought somehow melded into words. "Maybe just something part-time at first. Certainly I have the time." There'd be even more hours to fill next year. Before foreboding could form, she shoved the thought aside. Visions of how empty the house would be with Janie away could shatter her fledgling strength. Barbara looked delighted. "That's an excellent idea. Volunteering can be fulfilling, but a job, especially one you enjoy, can really provide one with a sense of purpose. What do you think you'd be interested in?" "I haven't gotten that far." Her pulse skipped a little, just considering it. Maybe, hopefully, from anticipation as much from trepidation. "There's no rush. I'm just in the reflection stage at the moment." "Well, I, for one, am all for..." Barbara's words trailed off as she swung into the drive. "That's not Janie's car out front, is it?" Claire turned to look. "No. Janie would park in the garage at any rate." At the thought of her daughter, she dug out her cell phone and checked to see if she'd received a recent text from her. But there was nothing since the one she'd gotten earlier, informing Claire that she'd gone to her appointment with Dr. Drake. "Maybe just a salesman, then. He's getting out of his car, see?" As the two women exited the vehicle, Claire saw a dark-haired man rounding the hood of a gray sedan and heading for the drive. Inexplicably, nerves clutched in her belly. "I'm looking for Claire Willard." She could feel Barbara moving closer to her side and felt a moment's gratitude for her friend's ever-vigilant protectiveness. "I'm Claire Willard." The man's smile made him look boyishly attractive. "I called a couple of times, but your maid said you were gone. I was on my way out of town and thought I'd swing by to see if you'd returned." He pulled off one glove and reached inside his coat to hand her something, which she took numbly. An official ID badge. "Special Agent Mark Foster, BCI. Is it okay if we go inside? I have a couple of questions for you." 15 minutes later, Claire was seated on the edge of the sofa in the family room. Had she asked Barbara to stay? She couldn't recall. But the woman had accompanied them into the house, retrieved coffee from the kitchen, and was handing out mugs. Claire's fingers wrapped tightly around hers. Marta must have left for the day. The distant thought flickered. She always made a fresh pot before leaving. David liked coffee after dinner. He never seemed to suffer the side effects of drinking caffeine before bedtime. "Mrs. Willard?" Belatedly, she became aware that both Mark and Barbara were looking at her. "I asked if it was okay to speak freely in front of your friend."
"Oh, yes," she glanced at the woman by her side. "Of course. What is this about?"
The agent took some folded sheets from the interior pocket of his jacket. "I can't tell you how sorry I am to bring up difficult memories, but I'm sure you've heard of Whitney DeVries's disappearance. As I told your husband, we're looking at any connections to your daughter's case."
His words seemed to come from a distance. "My husband?"
"Yes, when we spoke Friday. I'm sure he told you about our conversation." The man's smile was probably meant to be reassuring. "He was very helpful."
"Oh, yes, of course. I'm sorry."
Managing a laugh, she brought the coffee to her lips, forced herself to take a sip. She hadn't spoken to David since he'd called to say he would be away for the weekend again, although she knew he'd FaceTimed Janie.
"The weekend can be so busy. I'd completely forgotten."
"We are looking at any connections to your daughter's case." The words bounced around in her head like an internal echo. The world seemed to tilt on its axis. After all this time, all the news stories she'd been so certain were linked in some way to Kelsey, it hardly seemed possible. "This is something you filled out for the agent 7 years ago." Somehow, he was in front of her. He opened the pages he carried and handed them to her before returning to his seat. "It lists all your relatives, friends, acquaintances, everyone you knew even peripherally at the time your daughter went missing. I'd like to ask you to look it over and update it." She stared at the papers in her hand uncomprehendingly.
"I don't understand. How would it help?"
"They'll check for names that appear on your and David's lists and those that Shannon and Brian filled out."
Barbara touched her arm. "This can be a good thing, Claire. It means looking at Kelsey's case as well as this new one."
Her eyes filled. A good thing. Her mind was buzzing, her thoughts a jumble, but one thought rang through clear as a bell. If the two cases were connected, finding Whitney DeVries might also mean finding Kelsey. The rapid surge of hope left her weak.
"Of course."
Her voice was husky, so she took another drink. "Of course I'll update it." She'd do anything. Everything. Whatever it took for them to start looking into Kelsey's disappearance again. They'd have to, wouldn't they? If the agents were looking for links, that must mean they would comb through Kelsey's investigation, maybe see something the other agents hadn't, or chase a lead that hadn't been examined 7 years ago. It had been a long time since she'd allowed herself to feel this sort of wild, burgeoning joy.
"Thank you. I know this is painful. What about your daughter, Janie? Is she home?"
Her mind abruptly blanked.
"What? Why?"
Mark leaned forward in his chair, his hands clasped around the mug.
"I've been reading through Kelsey's file. Janie was a child 7 years ago, and her disability meant the agents weren't able to speak to her at the time. I thought now she might be in a better position to..."
"No."
As suddenly as the joy had come, it was replaced with rage, a hot, pulsing river of it.
"No, you will not be talking to my daughter. She's still a minor. We can prevent you from speaking to her."
Could they? Surely so.
"You have no idea what she went through after Kelsey."
Her voice broke then, and she could feel Barbara slipping an arm around her shoulders. The trauma was too much for her. She had a setback. Couldn't leave the house for almost 2 years. Couldn't go to school. We had to hire tutors. She shuddered at the memory of the double-edged tragedy. The one that had befallen the daughter they'd never seen again, and the other targeting the one who'd survived. "This can't affect her. I won't allow it."
"Janie still suffers from social anxiety," Barbara said from her side. "She's back in school, doing extremely well academically. But I'm sure her therapist would agree that drawing her into the middle of this wouldn't be beneficial for her."
The man's expression was somber.
"I didn't realize the ongoing nature of Janie's disorder. It's fine. I can get by without talking to her."
Until Barbara's arm tightened around her, Claire didn't realize she was shaking. In the last 5 years, Janie had made incredible strides, had slowly transitioned into public school again, then had gradually improved her attendance, her participation, and vocal responses. With her grades, it would be easy to forget that as far as she'd come, she still had miles to go to adjust to a socially interactive world. From Claire's conversations with Dr. Drake, she knew her daughter's anxiety would always remain with her, in some fashion. They couldn't protect her from that. But Claire could, and would, guard her from anything that threatened to disrupt the growth she'd made.
"You've been through the hardest thing a parent could endure," the agent said. "My being here, bringing it up again is difficult. Believe me, I know that. Just a couple of questions and I'll be out of your hair. Whitney DeVries disappeared on October 30th. That was a Friday night."
He paused expectantly.
"Do you recall where you were that evening?"
Claire raised a trembling hand to her forehead, rubbed at an ache that had appeared there.
Home, I guess."
"That would have been our auxiliary trick-or-trunk night," Barbara put in. "Remember, Claire? Before the football game, in the high school parking lot."
"Of course." "Now I do," I left here about 3.
She looked at her friend for agreement. We decided to buy more candy, although in the end we had more than enough. Her voice trailed off.
It was over by 7. I was home shortly after that.
Who was here with you? Her thoughts were scrambled.
Just Janie.
That was David's weekend in Columbus. My daughter's friend stayed the night. They were having a horror show marathon. The Halloween ones, I think. She'd made herself scarce for the duration. Claire didn't need Hollywood's rendition of horror. She lived with her own. He nodded. Your husband mentioned that you had once attended the same church as Brian DeVries's mother.
Yes, years ago.
Claire couldn't recall the last time she'd been to church. The faith that she'd been raised with had seemed to slip from her grasp after Kelsey was gone. Just one more thing that had vanished with her daughter. And you took the girls?
Kelsey more often than Janie, probably. But certainly both of them at times.
Kelsey is the only one who attended any youth activities. That would have been very difficult for Janie back then. And wouldn't be a favored activity even now. What sort of activities?
Claire tried to recall. Her mind was a hopeless jumble of thoughts. She sent a beseeching look to her friend, who put in smoothly,
There were youth church nights on Wednesdays, Bible school on Sundays, and I know our kids attended church camp at least a couple of summers together.
Seizing on the information, Claire nodded. Yes, Kelsey refused to go back to camp after the second time. By 12, she'd outgrown it, I think. The following year, I switched to a church here in town. I wasn't really a fan of the new pastor who'd taken over a couple of years earlier, even less of a fan of his wife. She sent an apologetic look to her friend. Barbara had been on the church board that had hired the Reverend Mickelson.
Mark looked at Barbara. What about you, Miss Hunt? Are you still a member of that church?
I am, yes. While I don't always agree with some of Reverend Mickelson's more conservative views, the church does a lot of good work for the community. I know Helen DeVries well, and am acquainted with her daughter-in-law.
And Whitney DeVries?
She's attended church occasionally with Helen. I've met her a time or two.
Did she ever take part in the youth activities that your family did?
Barbara smoothed her slacks with her free hand and took a sip from the mug she held. I wouldn't know. I don't have children that age anymore, and I haven't been on the church board for years.
The man stared at her for a moment before snapping his fingers. Barbara Hunt. I knew that name sounded familiar. You gave a statement after Kelsey Willard disappeared.
Claire stilled. She shouldn't have been surprised. Anyone connected to their family would have been questioned, and as much time as she'd spent with Claire, Barbara had known her family well. But something in the woman's face had needles of caution stabbing through her.
Yes. Mark used his free hand to check both his coat pockets before finding a notebook and drawing it out. Expertly, he flipped it open and thumbed through it. Stopped for a moment to read before glancing up again. You were the last on record to report seeing Kelsey Willard the day she disappeared.
Claire swayed in her seat. You saw Kelsey?
When? Where?
Barbara reached for her hand. She snatched it away.
You never told me that. Never. How could you not have told me that?
Her expression tortured. The woman said, I didn't see how it would help you to hear it. It was on Baltimore Street, about 3 miles from here. She was on her bike. I saw her for only an instant.
Kelsey's bike had been found much farther away than that. On Gilbert. Just around the corner and down the block from the fire station, which had been empty because it was staffed by volunteers on an as-needed basis. 6 miles from her house, the one Claire had forbidden her to leave, the one Kelsey had stormed out of anyway.
You're not going anywhere, young lady, not with that attitude, and not on a school night.
I wouldn't have an attitude if you weren't on my back about every little thing.
She'd shoved her arms through the sleeves of her jacket, her jaw jutted in a way that was becoming all too familiar.
Honestly, you're just so mercurial these days, I don't see.
That's just it, Claire. You don't see. You don't see anything because you're blind.
The slam of the door, like a rifle shot sounding through the house,
Her frantic calls to David, because of course, they had to go after her, find her. But no one had ever found Kelsey, and Claire had been left to replay that final scene over and over in her mind, picking it apart for clues to a puzzle she'd never solved.
"Do you have anything to add to your original statement, Miss Hunt?"
Barbara shook her head, looking miserable. The agent consulted his notes again.
"One thing you said struck me, that you glimpsed Kelsey well enough to be certain it was her, and that she looked anguished."
The walls were pressing in on her, squeezing the air from the room. Claire bolted to her feet with a suddenness that had the coffee sloshing over the edge of the mug.
"How could you?"
The words were a furious hiss.
"How could you keep that from me?"
She and David had clung to every bit of information the agents had shared with them, going over and over every word, wringing each detail to sift for precious news of their daughter. They'd certainly been told where Kelsey had last been seen, but not by whom. She looked anguished.
"Mrs. Willard, I don't think..."
"You have to leave, now."
It was an effort to put one foot in front of the other. The floor felt like quicksand shifting beneath her feet. Unsteady, she set the mug down on the end table as she went by.
"Both of you, go."
"Claire..." Barbara rushed after her, catching up with her at the staircase. "It didn't change anything, and I was trying to spare you, that's all. You didn't need..." With great effort, Claire turned her head to look at the other woman.
"You knew how desperate we were for every detail. Not sharing this with us. It was cruel. I told you how it felt for us to be kept in the dark by the police, the agents. For you to do the same thing, knowing that..."
The taste of betrayal was bitter.
"I didn't. At least, I mean, David knew. We decided there was no use burdening you with it. It doesn't change anything."
There was a part of her that knew that was true. Kelsey had been so angry when she left the house, a sudden temper that had seemingly bubbled out of nowhere and escalated into inexplicable fury. Maybe that temper had fueled her energy to ride 6 miles across town. In God's name, what had happened to her normally sunny-dispositioned daughter?
"Maybe not."
She turned, grasping the railing for the support she desperately needed and started upstairs.
"But that wasn't your decision to make. Or David's. You should have told me."
David Willard. November 9th, 4:38 p.m. David nosed his car out of the company parking lot, still riding a sense of euphoria. A co-worker honked at him, and he lifted a hand in acknowledgement. A group of colleagues was heading to a nearby pub for celebratory drinks. They'd allowed him to beg off when he'd cited parent-teacher conferences that evening, only on the condition that he'd join them the following night. With the news they'd just gotten, David had no doubt that spirits would still be high the next day. It was rare to leave one of Kurt's meetings with a glow, but learning that David and his team were up for no fewer than 3 awards on 2 different ad campaigns was enough to send his spirits skyrocketing. And not just any awards. One was for an EIA, the first such nomination in the history of the company. The showing was unprecedented. It was a career-making achievement for him as creative director for each of the ads. He stopped at a light, his fingers drumming lightly on the steering wheel. Even a very subdued Steve Grayson had congratulated him. The man knew as well as David did what the nominations would do for his clout with the agency and for his resume. With Janie off to college next year, there was nothing stopping him from looking for a job with a bigger agency, higher-profile clients, a more attractive salary package. The light switched to green, and he pressed on the accelerator. A nomination wasn't a win, but a man in his position could daydream, couldn't he? He let himself do exactly that for the entire drive across town. Pulling into his drive, he parked in the garage and, grabbing his suitcase from the back seat, headed for the house, a spring in his step. It was about damn time something in his life started going right. Claire! He stopped dead in the doorway of their bedroom, his bag in hand. Irritation flickered. The room was dark. She was sitting on the edge of the bed, unnaturally still. "I thought you'd be ready. We have conferences tonight." You didn't tell me you'd spoken to Agent Foster. Foster. His stomach plummeted. Shit. I'd planned to tonight. Why, did he call? He was here. When Barbara and I returned from setting up the church rummage sale. Son of a bitch. David strode to the bed, lifted the suitcase on it, and unzipped it. He'd told the man he hadn't wanted him at the house, hadn't he? Had informed him of Claire's fragile state. Apparently, that hadn't been direct enough. His earlier elation fading, he lifted two suits from the suitcase and carried them to the closet. Did he ask about the church you used to go to in Saxon Falls? When she didn't answer, he turned toward her. Claire? He said he was looking for connections between the two cases, Kelsey's and Whitney's. I knew. I've always known. I told you that day in your office. She had. The same way she'd insisted that every news story in the nation about a missing teen was somehow linked to Kelsey. He supposed, given the law of averages, at some point she was bound to be right. They might be, he emphasized, but at least they'll be taking a look at Kelsey's case again. Although he couldn't say he was any more impressed with Mark than he'd been with the cops and BCI agents 7 years ago. It doesn't mean they'll find anything new, or that they'll keep us abreast of developments as they arise. That observation was tinged with bitterness, honed by experience. You think they'll keep things from us? Her voice sounded far away, despite her proximity. The way you and Barbara kept something from me. He paused in his task. What are you talking about? She sounded off, looked vacant somehow, as if she were here, but not. He walked over to peer at her more closely. Was she on something? For a while she'd had an issue with sedatives and God knows what else the doctors had been giving her. But there had been no new prescription bottles in the medicine cabinet for years. David knew. He checked regularly. Barbara was the last one to report seeing Kelsey alive. Her voice hitched once, then steadied. She saw her on Baltimore, on her bike, looking anguished. She told you. Neither of you shared that with me. The accusation that sounded in her words was familiar, but she wasn't teetering on her usual hysteria. At least, not yet. He dropped heavily down on the bed beside her. Because it would upset you, and for what? It wasn't news. It didn't change anything. I used to have this dream. Her utter motionless was almost eerie, as if he were conversing with a statue. Still do, sometimes. It's the day Kelsey disappeared. I know that somehow, although all I see is a huge, poster-sized picture of her. And suddenly, it rips down the middle. I run to it and try to patch it, but I can't find any tape. And it tears again, then again, over and over, until all that's left are tiny little bits swirling around in a wind that's come up. I chase the pieces because I know if I can patch them all back together, Kelsey will be whole again. She'll be back. And I do somehow. But even with the repair, there are pieces gone. They blew away and were lost. Now she'll never return, because some of the parts are missing forever. For the first time, she looked at him. Do you understand? Yes. God help him, he did. I think it's the same way I felt when we thought the police were withholding details from us. Like, if we had a complete picture of the case, we'd somehow see something they hadn't. But it's a feeling, Claire. It's not true. Us knowing every fact wouldn't change anything. Just like you having completed the image in your dream wouldn't bring Kelsey back. His excitement on the drive home had been replaced by melancholy. Conversations with his wife too often had that effect on him. I couldn't protect my daughter when she needed me the most. I couldn't shield you from the hell we were plunged into. Janie started having more problems, and I couldn't change that either. But I could shelter you from some things that I knew only would hurt you. So yeah, I told Barbara to keep the information to herself. He braced himself for the outburst he was certain was coming. But she remained unnaturally still. It does, she whispered. Hurt. 6 miles she rode. She was last seen 30 minutes after she left the house, and she still appeared every bit as upset as she was when she'd slammed out. My last conversation with her was an argument. How do I forgive myself for that?
The words were like a knife slipped cleanly between his ribs, then twisted.
We can't change what happened, he said bleakly. We only can go on. I'm attending Janie's conference. Why don't you stay home and lie down for a while? I'll fill you in when I get back.
She didn't answer, but after a moment she rose and went to the adjoining bathroom, closed the door. He shot from the bed as if launched, strode out of the room. But try as he might, he couldn't leave her words behind, because he had dreams as well. A nagging nightmare in particular that he couldn't seem to shake. He, too, would like to change that final day. But even more, David wished he could undo one particular scene with his oldest daughter, the one that had put unalterable events into motion. In his dream, he relived those moments over and over, trying to edit the conversation that had changed everything between them. Sometimes Kelsey ran into his arms and called him Daddy, like she had when she was a little girl. She'd lose that snarky teen tone and the too-knowing attitude. He'd gotten very good over the years at revisionist history. Some of the time, he almost believed his own fabrication.
Special Agent Mark Foster, November 9th, 6:45 p.m. I appreciate you coming in. Mark showed Dane Starkey into the room. The man to whom Brian DeVries claimed to have lost a bet was slightly built, with slicked back thinning dark hair, a sharp nose, and receding chin. The truculence stamped on his expression gave him an unfortunate resemblance to a belligerent ferret.
It's not like I have much choice.
He grabbed a chair from the conference table, the leg scraping as he pulled it out enough to sink into. On the contrary, Mark said smoothly, we discussed several options.
And all of them sucked.
The man's head swiveled as he examined the space. Mark had chosen a conference area rather than an interview room in the BCI's main office in London.
But this was better than you coming to my workplace, or my house. Still not sure why we couldn't have done this on the phone.
Because then I couldn't show you these. Mark flipped open the folder in front of him and took out copies of Brian DeVries' financial transactions with the man. He pushed them across the table. Brian DeVries paid you a lot of money over the last 3 years. I want to know why. Not even a flicker of surprise. So DeVries had warned him. Mark had cautioned him against it, but wasn't surprised to find the man hadn't listened. He hadn't yet shown a propensity for following directions, which just made Mark more determined to discover what they were concealing.
I think you've got me mixed up with someone else.
It's been a long day. He slipped out of his suit coat and folded it over the back of his chair, watching the man's gaze go from the gun in his shoulder harness to the shield clipped to his belt. Leisurely, he took his seat, loosened his tie. Can't say I'm at my most patient after putting in 12 hours. So I'm only going to ask you one more time to explain those cash payments DeVries made to you. Starkey moistened his lips, picked up the sheets, and studied them more carefully.
Oh, yeah. I remember now. It was a bet. A stupid game we bet on. We both had a few and one thing led to another. The stakes got pretty high. I felt bad about Brian losing, so I let him pay it off over 3 years.
What game?
Perspiration
dotted the man's upper lip.
I don't really recall.
You won a $15,000 bet and you don't remember what game? Skepticism dripped from Mark's words. Try again.
Well, let me think. I guess it was the Bengals and the Vikings, 3 seasons ago.
And his memory clears. Mark smiled humorlessly. When and where did you two first meet?
At a farewell party. A friend of a friend.
Here's how this is going to go, Dane. The more you lie to me, the more I'm going to think you have something to hide. He raised a hand to silence the man's objection. The more I think you're concealing something, the more I'm going to wonder what it is. That'll get my imagination going. And I'm going to start imagining, hey, Maybe this guy's lying because he had something to do with the kidnapping of Brian DeVries' daughter.
That's bullshit!
Starkey shot out of his chair. Is it? Mark reached for the water pitcher sitting on the table between them and poured himself a glass. Drank. I don't think so. You guys being such good buddies and all, you probably know all about his family. Maybe met them. The man was sweating in earnest now.
No, I haven't. I mean, I barely even know Brian.
Well enough to meet up for drinks, though, right? Alone? Because I'm not hearing you mention others who witnessed this $15,000 bet. Sit down. Mark waited for him to comply before saying, Where were you the evening of October 30th?
Man, I don't know, but I wasn't anywhere near Saxon Falls.
Dane, Mark leaned forward. I've already got investigators on you. They're sniffing around your job, your family, your friends. Everyone's gonna know the BCI is asking questions about you. Pretty soon they'll be asking why. They'll start looking at you differently. Because if we're interested in you, there's probably reason, right? And we're gonna find out exactly what you're lying about. And then, because you forced me to waste manpower on your lying ass, I'm gonna nail you to the wall for doing whatever it is that you don't want to tell me you did. Starkey slumped back in his chair.
Fucking DeVries. And he comes out of this smelling like a rose, right? Walks away clean, just like always.
When did he walk away? What did he walk away from? The man looked away, stubbornly silent. That's a whole lot of pent-up hostility you have against the man. Makes me consider whether it's enough to drive you to kidnap his daughter.
I'm not the one that likes little girls, okay? You ask DeVries about that, why don't you?
Adrenaline spiked. If Starkey had evidence to back up his claim, it could be a critical turning point. There was a reason investigators always first looked at the parents in cases like this, but DeVries had passed a background check prior to getting a job in law enforcement. If Starkey was telling the truth, how the hell had that happened? I'll do that. But right now I'm asking you, why did DeVries pay you $15,000?
He owed a hell of a lot more.
The man punctuated his words with a fist to the table.
He should have gone to juvie, the perverted little prick. My cousin was 12. 12 fucking years old when he molested her.
Everything inside him quieted. 12 years old. 2 years younger than Whitney DeVries. And how old was he? A sulky shrug.
I don't know. 15? Got it all swept under the rug. Went to counseling. But he sure didn't get sent away. Then I hear he's a cop now? There ought to be a damn law about that.
Paraphilia often started in the teen years, Mark thought quickly. If DeVries had a juvie record that had been sealed, possibly even expunged after a number of years, it wouldn't have shown up on a background check. Smaller police forces didn't use polygraph tests, so DeVries wouldn't have had to worry about trying to pass en route to landing a job with the sheriff's office. So you decided to blackmail him.
I thought it was time for him to pay. For once in his miserable life, he was gonna know what it was like to be powerless. See how he liked it.
What'd you do with the money? When Starkey didn't answer, Mark pressed him. You being so concerned about your cousin, I figure when she's asked, she'll say you gave it to her, right? For her emotional suffering? The answer was written in the other man's expression.
Just because Shelley's moved on doesn't mean DeVries shouldn't have to suffer, finally. I'm the one who learned he got that job with the sheriff's office, so I laid the groundwork. I didn't suggest anything illegal. Plenty of people in my family in Columbus remember what happened, even if he didn't live around there for long. Wouldn't take much to plan a story about it in his local newspaper. And that's what I told him. DeVries is the one who mentioned making it worth my while not to do it.
How'd you contact him? They hadn't found anything on DeVries' home computer or cell that linked to Starkey.
Used my day off to wait for him in the parking lot outside his office.
A flicker of pride crossed Starkey's face.
He didn't remember me at first. But once I started talking, he couldn't wait to get me out of there. Had me meet him at some dive bar a few miles away. This was the only contact we had. He just mailed me the checks on the yearly dates we agreed on.
Ever late for a payment? The man swung his head back and forth.
A guilty conscience makes a man punctual.
And how much did he agree to pay in total?
20,000. He still owes me another 5. We agreed on a 4-year payment plan.
I wouldn't start spending the rest if I were you. Mark nudged a legal pad toward the man. Write it down. All of it. I want dates and names of anyone who can verify the story about your cousin, phone numbers and addresses, then write a full accounting of your meeting with DeVries. And while you're at it, include where you were the night of October 30th. The man picked up the pen, tapped it restlessly on the pad.
I don't have to give the money back, right? It was a business transaction between 2 consenting parties.
Yeah, extortionists often describe it that way. Catching the eye of his sack through the small glass window in the door, Mark rose. Don't leave anything out. He left Starkey to the task and walked out of the room. Special Agent in Charge Todd Bennett jerked his head toward the man Mark had left behind.
Think he's good for the girl's kidnapping?
The sack had been watching the interview in the next room on CCTV. He and DeVries just jumped to the top of my suspect list. Mark looked back to consider the door he'd just left. There must be something to Starkey's story for DeVries to pay him that much money. I need to take a run at him. Craw talked to him about the money the first time, and he flat out lied about it.
Maybe the money's only the start.
Bennett's voice was grim.
Could be our friend in there. Also planned for DeVries' daughter to suffer the same thing his cousin did.
As far as motivation went, revenge was the most solid one they'd encountered so far. Mark nodded grimly. I'll be all over his alibi, he promised. I've already done a preliminary check on him. He doesn't have a criminal history, but we'll dig deeper. If a cousin of the alleged victim could be driven to blackmail Brian DeVries, what might the girl's immediate family be capable of? Starkey wasn't the only family member that required investigation. It's also possible that the guy's just an opportunist. He saw a chance to stick it to DeVries and make some money at the same time. And for all his professed indignation on his cousin's behalf, it doesn't sound like he shared the money with her. The sack's faded brown gaze was shrewd.
Interesting that the DeVries case never showed up in the law enforcement background check.
Lifting a shoulder, Mark said, it wouldn't if it had been sealed or expunged. But Starkey would have had to have been a teenager himself at the time. Maybe he doesn't know all the details. We don't even know at this point if it got reported. I'll find out. Todd nodded. He couldn't be much over 50, but his hair was prematurely white. It glistened under the fluorescent lights.
Agent Greg Larson has taken over profiling duties for us in the last couple years. He's acquainted himself with the Kelsey Willer case, should you ever want his input.
This was news to Mark. He hadn't known the agency had replaced Luther Sims. I might do that. Switching the subject, he said, Ben mentioned you had another agent in mind to take his place on the case.
Don't worry. I haven't forgotten you.
Great. I've got so many loose threads on this case, I'm starting to feel like a cat chasing a laser pointer. When's he start?
Not he.
Bennett took his vibrating cell from his pocket, looked at the screen.
She. You've worked together before. Sloan Medford will be in West Bend the day after tomorrow.
The man had already turned to answer the call before he finished the sentence. Then he strode away. It was just as well. Mark wasn't sure he was a good enough actor to keep the dismay from his expression. Sloan Medford.
God damn it.
The clouds were charcoal smears across the sky, extinguishing every hint of light. Mark got turned around twice before finding the private drive he'd been directed to. It opened to a small clearing in front of a neatly built log cabin. From the twin spears of his headlights, he could see the front door open and someone step outside onto the porch. Luther Sims, the retired BCI profiler who'd worked the 10-mile killer case. Mark brought the vehicle to a halt. It had been pretty clear how Ben Craw had felt about Sims being brought in on the Willard disappearance 7 years earlier, but for now, Mark was the lead on this investigation. And after spending hours the last several nights poring over the old case files, he knew he'd be remiss in not getting first-hand information from the BCI's expert on the TMK. Getting out of the car, he zipped up his coat before walking toward the cabin. It was still chilly, but without the torturous Arctic wind from earlier that day. Mr. Sims, There was a ramp leading up to the porch. He climbed the steps next to it and stuck out his hand. Mark Foster, thanks for agreeing to meet me. Sorry about the hour. Agent. Sims's handshake was firm. Don't worry about the time. As I said on the phone, we just got home only a few hours ago ourselves. He jerked a thumb at a small SUV parked in front of a detached double garage. It still had a canoe fastened to the racks on top. Still haven't completely unpacked. First matter of business when we arrived was to get Elizabeth, my wife, situated. Please come in. Mark followed the older man through the cabin door, wiped his boots thoroughly on the hooked rug just inside as he looked around. This is cozy. How long have you lived here?
Since my retirement 3 years ago.
Sims's tone was hushed.
We love it, although given the progression of Elizabeth's rheumatoid arthritis, I've been making some improvements to the place.
Two rooms opened off the hallway. On the right, dim light spilled through the half-open door. Mark could see a woman sitting upright in bed, holding a book in gnarled fingers, reading glasses perched on her nose. Her long gray hair framed a face that from this distance seemed curiously unlined. Respectfully, he averted his eyes. On the left was a good-sized family room with a small flat-screen TV and several photos adorning the walls. He recognized Sims and his wife in a dated wedding picture. A much younger Luther in an army uniform, the two of them holding up the respective fish they'd caught, and one that might be a somber Elizabeth Sims taken decades earlier.
Let's go to the kitchen where we won't disturb my wife.
Mark followed the man down the hall where it opened onto a good-sized kitchen with a center island and a table and chairs. Luther pulled out a chair, waved Mark to it. It was a moment before he sat.
Pretty view.
Better during the day, I'm sure. The back wall was a bank of windows. The shades hadn't yet been drawn, showing a deep lawn that was hemmed on three sides by tree line.
We like it. Both Elizabeth and I enjoy the outdoors.
At least, the man said with a quick glance toward the bedroom.
She used to. She has to depend on the wheelchair more and more, and recently she was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's. It's frustrating for her. His smile held a tinge of sadness. Still managed a couple canoe rides on our recent trip, though.
Mark sank into the chair. The woman's diagnosis would explain the locks discreetly placed below the handles on the kitchen drawers and cupboards. They'd done the same at his grandma's house before the disease progressed, and she'd been placed in a nursing home.
Where'd you go?
Spent 3 weeks at Berlin Lake. The fishing wasn't great this year, but the fall foliage was spectacular.
He seemed to stop himself then, chuckling ruefully.
Listen to me. 3 years out of the agency, and it's fishing, hiking, and canoeing that fill my thoughts. A far cry from my work days.
Mark shot him an easy smile.
That's what retirement is supposed to be about, isn't it?
Sims nodded. He was late 60s, Mark figured, and had kept most of his hair, although silver had heavily encroached on the brow. At 5'10", maybe 160, he hadn't let himself go since leaving the agency.
You look like you're a good way from retirement, so let's talk about what brought you here. You're working the kidnapping over in Saxon Falls.
I am. Given its proximity to West Bend, we have to look for connections to the Kelsey Willard case, which you were involved in.
There was a subtle shift in Sims's demeanor, in his eyes. The relaxed look vanished from his expression, and he was a cop again.
Like you, I worked the Special Investigations Unit, originally out of Athens. But the last dozen years or so, I was loaned out to any serial crime investigation.
Because of your profiling experience. The man nodded.
My SAC asked me to attend the first couple of classes at Quantico. It was extensive training, and I studied even more on my own. The agency provided regular opportunities after that to keep up with it. It wasn't something I planned, but it ended up defining my career.
You were the one who linked 8 deaths, attributed them to the same killer.
Unofficially, I attributed 12 homicides to the 10-mile killer.
The man's correction surprised Mark.
I believe that 8 of the bodies found in the last 20 years could be linked to him. Another I dismissed as the work of a copycat. There were subtle differences in the bruising around the throat, the costuming, and the way the victims were positioned. The other four girls I suspect he's guilty of killing were never found. Kelsey Willard is one of them. At least I haven't heard that her body was discovered. Mark shook his head. No, but it sounds like you were convinced the TMK was responsible from almost the beginning of her case, so there must be more than the final appearance of the bodies that link his victims. The man turned a hand. I identified some similarities, yes. All females, ranging from 14 to 16 when they disappeared. There were physical resemblances. They were dark-haired and slender, attractive. The bodies that were found were clad in leotards, tutus, tights, and ballet slippers, although some of the girls had dancing experience while others hadn't. All had been manually strangled in the same way. The pattern of bruising on the throat was remarkably similar. None of them showed signs of sexual abuse, although not all of them were virgins. The body dumps were located in fairly remote areas, within approximately 10 miles of one another in the Wayne National Forest in the southeastern part of the state, and every one of them had a parent that was lacking in some way. Sometimes it was the mother, but most frequently the father. He took a breath, then gave a wry smile. Admittedly, the last link is the most subjective, and evaluating parents who are in the midst of trauma is hardly fair. But the more you dig into the family dynamics, the more you discover about the relationships before the kidnappings. I was still working on strengthening that premise when I retired from the agency. A parent that was lacking in some way. Mark considered the words. If Starkey was to be believed, Brian DeVries had sex with a preteen girl when he was a teenager himself. If he'd carried a fetish for girls into adulthood, there had been nothing uncovered in his home or on his computer to suggest it. But if Mark dug into that portion of Brian DeVries' life, he might find that this secret from the man's past had impacted his daughter in some less obvious way. Whitney DeVries' kidnapper posed as a teenage boy from a neighboring town and lured her to a meeting place. Does that match with any of the other disappearances you linked to the TMK? Sims thought for a minute. No. In the first two cases, the killer snatched them out of their homes from their beds. In the other instances, the girls disappeared when they were out of the house alone. But as you know, M.O.'s change. They reflect opportunity, and the offender can adapt and polish his M.O. to better suit his purpose. The agent I was partnered with at the beginning of this case seemed to think there was some dissension about whether Kelsey Willard was a victim of the TMK. There was, yes. The lead agent working the case was rather dismissive of the theory. His shrug was almost imperceptible. Forensic profiling is still regarded suspiciously by some in our profession. As I recall, the man was going to remain unconvinced until the body was found and definitively matched the physical similarities I just shared. But you don't think all of the TMK's victims were discovered? The man shook his head decisively. Have you seen the TMK files? Mark nodded. The files were stored in more than 30 boxes in a cold case room. Much of the information had been uploaded, and he'd requested it, but even the computer files would take a week to go through. I'm just starting. A quick flash of a smile from Sims. Be sure and take a close look at the photos from the dumps. You'll see how isolated the areas were. Many of the bodies had remained undiscovered for years. And he hunted within the state lines? As far as we know. The way he left the bodies is a pretty distinctive detail. It would have popped up on CODIS if he'd emulated that elsewhere. It's probable that he hunted only within the state boundaries. That made us think he was a resident or hailed from a surrounding state close to the border. But we couldn't rule out someone who passed through on a frequent basis, like a salesman or trucker. What was the closest proximity between victims? Sim shot him an approving glance. You're thinking of the DeVries and Willard girls. Their towns are, what, 15 miles apart? 12. The man pulled at his lower lip, considering. Dahlia Humphreys and Iris Johnson,
Victims 4 and 8. Their homes were around 20 miles apart. But there were 3 victims and approximately 9 years between them. Was Whitney DeVries the work of a copycat? Mark wondered. She'd been kidnapped using a very different process than any of the other victims. It could point to an offender who had perfected his strategy, or it could mean a totally different offender altogether. So you can't estimate how long the killer keeps his victims, because of the amount of time some of the victims went undiscovered? The shortest interval between linked kidnappings has been 3 years. Piecing together the forensic anthropologist's reports on the remains, I concluded he kept them all for months, some for more than a year. But I don't have a lot of answers for you, Agent Foster. The man's tone was tinged with defeat. I spent a third of my career studying those crimes, and I'm left with more questions than answers. You take some of these cases with you when you leave. He tapped a finger to his temple. Up here, especially the unsolved ones. This is the one that has always haunted me. I'm not ashamed to tell you that I used to have nightmares after another body was discovered. Didn't make for a peaceful sleep. It got so bad that I came home one day and Elizabeth had hung a framed print on the wall above our bed, one by that famous artist, the guy who painted the ballerinas. Mark shook his head. He knew nothing about art. The other man continued. She used to tell me to focus on the picture before I went to sleep, so I dream about it instead of the bodies. Darned if that didn't help. He stopped, looking a bit embarrassed about the admission before switching the subject. The crime is about the offender. His wants, his needs. So what is it he wanted, and how did each of the victims fail him? Because that's what their deaths represented. Their failure to satisfy whatever it was that he desired from them. If you can answer that question, you'll break this case. Put like that, solving this thing seemed even more insurmountable. Mark saw the man glance at the kitchen clock. Following his gaze, he was shocked to find it was nearly 9 p.m. I've kept you long enough. He still had another 40 miles to drive back to West Bend. Fortunately, he'd FaceTimed Nikki last night because it was too late now. He had hours ahead of him with reports from local law enforcement and diving into the Willard file again. He rose. Sims didn't object as he got up and ushered him from the room and down the hallway. When they reached the bedroom, the man reached out to close the door, but not before Mark's gaze was drawn involuntarily to the print on the wall. A dreamy picture of dancers in filmy pink tutus, hands posed gracefully over their heads. A stark contrast to the photos of victims taken at the dump sites. The door clicked shut. I always promised myself that picture would come down when the killer was behind bars, Sims said quietly. That's up to you and your team now. A tall order, Mark thought. He wondered what he'd use to ward off nightmares if they failed to find Whitney DeVries in time. They continued toward the door. Because of the proximity of the DeVries and Willard victims, we're looking hard for any connections to the Willard case. Mark pulled out the gloves he jammed in his pockets. As you should. Was there anything that stood out to you about it? Anything that never quite gelled? That happened with every investigation, Mark knew. Unanswered questions, the kind Sims had alluded to. The man rubbed his face, for the first time looking weary. Every investigator has his bugaboos, the things he or she can really get hung up on. Me, I was never satisfied with the alibis given by 2 of the people questioned. Of course, we know that not everyone can account for every minute of their day. Others live alone with no convenient corroborating witnesses, but it always leaves me with questions. Do you remember who they were? Without hesitation, Sims answered. Of course. The Reverend Mickelson and Kelsey's father, David Willard.
Whitney DeVries, November 10th, 5:34 p.m.
Whitney, dear, Dread snaked down her spine. Oh, God, that voice. That tone. Her body recognized it. Instinctively knew she was in danger. She sat cross-legged on the stage, as she'd been instructed.